Chapter 9. The Rule of the Order. And behold, at evening tide trouble, and before the morning he is not. This is the portion of them that spoil us and the lot of them that rob us. Isaiah 17:14. 5 men rule the world. This council of 5 consists of Baron Guy D. Rothschild, Evelyn D. Rothschild, George Pratt Schultz, Robert Russo, from Bush's family firm of Brown Brothers Harriman, and one vacancy, at this writing. In the past several years, members of the council who have died include Admiral Harriman, Lord Victor Rothschild, and Prince Thurnwin Taxis of Regensburg, Germany. None of them holds public office, but they choose who shall hold office in the nations. These 5 men comprise the apex of the pyramid of power, the world order. We may ask, why should there be a world order? Is it not sufficient to hold absolute power in a single nation, or in a group of nations? The answer is no, because of the nature of international travel, international trade, and international finance. International travel requires that a person may travel in peace from one nation to another, without being molested. Excepting cases of anarchy, revolution or war, this requirement can usually be met. International trade requires that traders of one nation can go to another nation, transact their business, and return with their goods or their profits. This requirement too is usually met. If not, the offended nation can exercise military force, as Great Britain did in its opium wars. It is the third requirement, international finance, which called into being the world order. In earlier days, when international trade consisted of barter, payment in gold or silver or piracy, the seizure of goods by force, there was no need for a world arbiter to determine the value of instruments of trade. The development of paper money, stocks, bonds, acceptances and other negotiable instruments necessitated a power, able to exercise influence anywhere in the world, to declare that a piece of paper represented $1 billion in real wealth, or even $1 in real wealth. An entry on a computer, flashed from London to New York, states that someone, 273, owes $5 billion to someone else. Without genuine power backing, no such sum could ever be collected, regardless of the factuality or morality of the debt. As anyone in the mafia can tell you, you don't collect, unless you are willing to break legs. The world order is always prepared to break legs, and break them they do, by the millions. What would have happened to the earliest settlers in America, if they had gone to the Indians and said, "Give us your goods and the deeds to your homes and lands. In return, we will give you this beautifully printed piece of paper." The Indians would, and did, attack them. If the settlers arrived with an army led by a Pizarro or a Cortez, they took the lands without a piece of paper. The world order rules with its pieces of paper, but behind every paper is a force which can be employed anywhere in the world. The force may be disguised by various subterfuges as international agreements, associations or other camouflage, but its base is always force. The world order rules through a simple technique, divide and conquer, divide et impera. Every natural or unnatural division among people, every occasion for hatred or greed, is exploited and exacerbated to the limit. The polarization of racial and ethnic groups in the U.S. is accelerated by a flood of government decrees, originating in foundation studies, which are designed solely to set American against American. Only in this way can the world order maintain its iron grip on the daily lives of the people. The world order also rules by the principle of 1984, no groups of 2 or more people are allowed to gather, unless the world order has a representative present. If you start a club of dandelion fanciers, the order will send someone who will be quietly helpful, avoid taking the front position, and who will offer to pay the rent of a meeting place or the printing of the minutes. In more radical groups, the order's representative will be the first to suggest dynamiting a building, assassinating an official, or other violent action. The international terrorism of the Communist Party originated in a small club of German and French workingmen in Paris, dedicated, 274, to quiet reading and discussion, until Karl Marx joined. It was then converted into a revolutionary group. This one example explains the order's determination to allow no group, however insignificant, to remain unmonitored. The world order adopted the Hegelian dialectic, the dialectic of materialism, which regards the world as power, and the world as reality. It denies all other powers and all other realities. It functions on the principle of thesis, antithesis and asynthesis, which results when the thesis and antithesis are thrown against each other for a predetermined outcome. Thus the world order organizes and finances Jewish groups, it then organizes and finances anti-Jewish groups, it organizes communist groups, it then organizes and finances anti-communist groups. It is not necessary for the order to throw these groups against each other, they seek each other out like heat-seeking missiles, and try to destroy each other. By controlling the size and resources of each group, the world order can always predetermine the outcome. In this technique, members of the world order are often identified with one side or the other. John Foster Dulles arranged financing for Hitler, but he was never a Nazi. David Rockefeller may be cheered in Moscow, but he is not a communist. However, the order always turns up on the winning side. A distinguishing trait of a member of the world order, although it may not be admitted, is that he does not believe in anything but the world order. Another distinguishing trait is his absolute contempt for anyone who actually believes in the tenets of communism, Zionism, Christianity, or any national, religious or fraternal group, although the order has members in controlling positions in all of these groups. If you are a sincere Christian, Zionist or Muslim, the world order regards you as a moron and worthy of respect. You can and will be used, but you will never be respected. It has taken centuries of patient effort for the world order to attain the power it exercises today. Its origins, as an international force, go back to the Phoenician slave traders, continues through the Phnariot families of the Byzantine Empire, then the Venetian and Genoese traders and bankers of the Middle Ages, who moved into Spain and Portugal, and later into England and Scotland. By the 14th century, the 275 Genoese controlled the Scottish landlords. The imperial family of the Byzantine Empire, the Palaiologs, meaning the word, were attacked by the Gnostic faction, whose materialistic Aristotelian philosophy was the forerunner of Hegelian dialectic and Marxism. The Palaiologs devoutly believed in the Christian faith, as expressed by the Orthodox Rite. The materialistic Venetian and Genoese armies, with the aid of the Turkish infidels, looted and conquered Constantinople, the legendary city of God. The Byzantine survivors recreated their culture in Russia, with Moscow as the Third Rome. The plan to destroy the Orthodox Church and its Romanov, New Rome, leader was the hidden goal of the First World War. The victors came away with $1 billion of the Romanov fortune, after achieving the defeat of their hated enemy, the Orthodox Church. During the Middle Ages, European power centers coalesced into two camps, the Ghibellines, those who supported the emperor's Hohenstaufen family, an Italian adaptation of Wimblingen, the name of the Hohenstaufen estate, and the Guelphs, from Wealth, the German prince who competed with Frederick for control of the Holy Roman Empire. The Pope then allied himself with the Guelphs against the Ghibellines, resulting in their victory. All of modern history stems directly from the struggle between these two powers. The Guelphs, also called the Neri, or Black Guelphs, and Black Nobility, were the Normans who conquered England in the 1st century, the Genoese who backed Robert Bruce in his conquest of Scotland, and who supported William of Orange in his seizure of the throne of England. William's victory resulted in the formation of the Bank of England and the East India Company, which have ruled the world since the 17th century. Every subsequent coup d'etat, revolution and war has centered in the battle of the Guelphs to hold and enhance a fear power, which is now the world order. The power of the Guelphs grew through their control of banking and international trade. It was extended through the Italian centers to the north of Florence, in Lombardy, which became great financial centers. All Italian bankers, including the Genoese, the Venetians, and Milanese, were referred to as Lombards, Lombard, in German. 276. Means deposit bank. The Lombards were bankers to the entire medieval world. Modem history begins with the transfer of their operations north to Hamburg, Amsterdam, and finally to London. The great American fortunes originated with the Guelph slave trade to the colonies. Many of the slave traders doubled in piracy. Trinity Church, whose leading vestryman later was J.P. Morgan, was originally known as the Church of the Pirates. Captain William Kidd provided the material to build it in 1697, and a pew was reserved for him. He was arrested the next year, and hanged in chains at Newgate. In 1711, A slave market was set up on Wall Street near the church, and functioned there for many years. Two of the most powerful influences in the world today are the international drug trade, which began with the East India Company, and international espionage, which began with the Bank of England. The East India Company was granted a charter in 1600 in the closing days of Queen Elizabeth's reign. In 1622, under James I, it became a joint stock company. In 1661, in an attempt to retain his throne, Charles II granted the East India Company the power to make war. From 1700 to 1830, the East India Company gained control of all India, and wrested the historic monopoly of opium from the great Mughals. The crown periodically tried to maintain control of the monster it had unleashed. State Papers, Domestic, Interregnum, SV, No. 97, 1649-51, states, whereas several warrants have been obtained by the East India Company for the transporting of several great quantities of gold and silver, the ilk sometimes is granted to several merchants and others upon thoropetion and suggestions, and whereas under killer of this warrants to divers other great sums of money, both English gold and silver is transported out of the nation, WCH might be prevented if the stat would apprentice own controlled one skilled in this affair, to tack a view and search of all badge and cases of treasure that are transported out of the nation, and to see to the packing and making up of said treasure, and that there be sent no more than what the stat gives license. 277. For, both for quantity and quality, and registered, and returned yearly to the Council of Stat, and that the SD controller for his view and search and sealing and marking it up shall demand and have 2 shillings upon every £100 sterling by tale, or the value of every £100 sterling, if that the gold or silver should be in bears or ingots, for all gold and silver that shall be exported by license, either the East India Company or any other person whomsoever, and that it shall not be lawful for any man to transport gold or silver before it be viewed and examined by the point violet or his sufficient deputy, and registered. Government supervision of control of international movements of gold and silver has been a national problem, since Cicero inveighed against it in the Roman Forum. Sir Walter Raleigh pointed out, in his Select Observations of the Incomparable Sir Walter Raleigh, Mix VP 6, 1, that nation can only be in a prosperous estate that hath a proportionable quantity of silver or gold to balance the strength and trade of its neighboring nations. 2, that whilst the current cash of this kingdom can be converted into bullion, and so made a trading commodity as hath been practiced this 100 years, 'twill either be conveyed to be best market, or wrought in plate at home, notwithstanding the utmost rigor and vigilancy, to the great and daily consumption of the coin, and detriment of the nation. That raising the value of our coin is the only certain means to keep it in the nation to make us a rich and thriving state, to recover our lost trade, and the best bulwark and defense against all the attacks of our enemies. That contrary to the policy of nations, our standard coin is of greater value in all places than at home, Spain only excepted, for which reason we bring Spanish money hither, and for the same reason our money is transported to other places, to the great impoverishment of the nation. Sir Walter Raleigh, a patriot, saw that the machinations of the international money dealers were bringing ruin to many Englishmen, and tried to stop it. They in turn conspired against him, and had him beheaded. The order invariably enlists the law against its enemies. 278. The East India Company originated as the London Staplers, was later known as the London Mercers Company, merchant guilds which held monopolies over certain avenues of commerce. It was a direct offshoot of the commercial banking establishments of Northern Italy, Venice and Genoa. Related firms were the German Hansa, and the Hanse of the Low Countries, which was headquartered in Bruges. It was also allied with the Levant Company and the Anglo-Muscovy Company. Sebastian Cabot, whose descendants are prominent in the American banking and intelligence, raised the seed money for Anglo-Muscovy in Italy and London. The company operated northern overland trade routes from the Baltic to India and China. Other related firms were the London Company, chartered in 1606 to establish the Virginian plantation on a communistic basis, and the Plymouth Company, whose descendants control the New England business world. The city banks, which dominate American finance and politics, code name for banks for the city, financial district of London, descend directly from East India and Bank of England operations. The Rockefeller Empire is the most prominent scion of this dynasty. To aid their control of finance and politics, the Guelphs perpetuated a host of cults deriving from the Manichaeans, which in turn derived from the cults of Babylonia and Iura, from the Etes cultus of the Caucasian area, and from Hindu pantheism. Their offshoots include the Bogmils of the Balkans, the Polakans of Asia Minor, Phoenobatists, Communists and Antinomians, centering in the Catharists, the Albigensians of southern France, the Paterines of northern Italy, and the English Savoyards. These Gnostic faiths developed into the Rosicrucians, Swedenborgians, Unitarians, the Fabian Society, and the World Council of Churches. The English Savoyards became active in the London staplers and the rise of oceanic commerce by using the Venetian Flanders galley, which brought the Latin sail into Europe from Southeast Asia. The Savoyards formed an extreme left-wing party, led by John Ball, which called for the nationalization of all land. The Wycliffe-Lollards Savoyards staplers formed the King's Party against the landed nobility, republicanism, and parliament. Then as now, the left-wing sought ownership of all land through an absolute ruler and a totalitarian centralized government. 27 Macron. This left-wing alliance culminated in the University of London. The University of London, which received a $2 million grant in 1924 from Beardsley Rummel, as head of the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Fund, and many other grants from American foundations houses Gresham College and the London School of Economics, where Harold Laski taught John F. Kennedy and David Rockefeller the principles of the world order. The University of London was originally financed by Jeremy Bentham of the East India Company, and John Stuart Mill, whose friend, investment banker George Grote, gave the University of London £6,000 to study mental health, the origin of the present worldwide mental health movement. Grote also contributed £500 to finance the July Revolution in France in 1830, which put Louis Philippe on the throne. It was Bentham who first coined the slogan later taken up by Karl Marx, the greatest good for the greatest number, which has been so useful in inflaming the masses, the Marxist flim-flam that you can best serve your interests by serving others. Bentham's business partner was manufacturer Robert Owen, an atheist who taught free love. Like most do-gooders, Owen's cotton mills in Asia, associated with the East India Company, caused bankruptcies and great misery in India. In 1824, Owen bought Father Rapp's Anabaptist commune in America, Harmony on the Wabash, renaming it New Harmony. Owen's associate at New Harmony was Frances Fanny Wright, who initiated the practice of free love in America. She also started the women's equal rights movement, which was intended to break up families by inciting war between husband and wife. She traveled through the South, preaching the amalgamation of the races, and founded a commune in Tennessee for Negro freedmen. In 1829, she helped found the Workingmen's Party in New York City, which later became the Communist Party. Her grandson, Reverend W. M. Norman Guthrie, who married Ann Norton Stewart, became known as the Red Vicar at his church, St. Mark's in the Bowery, which welcomed Luciferians to its services. A principal offspring of the East India Company was the Fabian Society, founded by Sidney and Beatrice Potter Webb, whose father, Richard Potter, was a close friend of John Stuart Mill. Beatrice's sister Georgina married Daniel Meenertshagen, chairman of Lazard Brothers. London, another sister, Thirsa, married Sir Alfred Cripps. John Stuart Mill's father, James, who was with the East India Company, named his son after John Stuart. Head of East India Company John Stuart Mill was secretary of the East India Company from 1856 until its dissolution. One of Mill's most famous disciples, David Ricardo, originated the theory of rents, later expounded by the Marxists, and the bare subsistence law of wages. His descendant, Rita Ricardo, married to Wesley Campbell, head of the Hoover Institution, now advises President Reagan on Social Security. Robert Owen, promoter of the New Harmony Commune, was a principal backer of John Quincy Adams' presidential campaign. Adams had withheld support from Madison during the War of 1812, and had threatened secession from the Union. As Secretary of State, Adams had drafted the Monroe Doctrine, which gave the British East India Company control of all Latin American markets, while keeping out all of its competitors. T.D. Allman, In the Doctrine That Never Was, Harper's, January 1984, revealed that Monroe actually pledged not to interfere with any European power unless they set up new colonies. The agreement, which was not even called the Monroe Doctrine until many years later, guaranteed the East India Company its markets in this hemisphere. When Britain violated the agreement in 1833 by seizing the Malvinas, the U.S. did nothing. The New England banking and shipping interests controlled by Adams Group created the Second Bank of the United States by repeated stock speculation campaigns, marked by typical bouts of hyperinflation and sudden deflation, which gave them control of millions of acres of farmlands throughout the Mississippi Valley from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. This gave them enormous political influence in this entire region, allowing them to seed the southern Mississippi Valley with fanatical secessionists and abolitionists, whose revolutionary acts made the Civil War inevitable. Owen also coined the term socialism. He was a business partner of a cotton manufacturer named Ingalls, whose son later became his. 280. 281. Political disciple, and still later became the partner of Karl Marx in founding the world communist movement. The trail of the conspirators has been evident throughout the history of Europe, since the Middle Ages. In 1547, the Republic of Venice had learned of an anti-Christian conspiracy, and strangled its leaders, Gioian Trevisano and Francis di Rugno. The surviving conspirators, Alcinous, Lilius Socinus, Piruta, Gentilus, Schottchiri, Francis Lenoir, Darius Socinus, Alicus, and the Abbe Leonard, now spread their poisonous doctrines of hatred throughout Europe. Their message of anarchy, atheism and immorality, leveling and revolution brought bloodshed in every subsequent upheaval on the continent. In Germany, Adam Weishaupt, Prof. of Canon Law at the University of Munich, and later at Coburg Gotha, became the nominal head of the Illuminati. Its corresponding branch in Italy was the Alta Vendita, whose first leader was an Italian nobleman, B. Nubius. His principal agent was Piccolo Tigrer, a Jewish banker and jeweler who traveled for the Alta Vendita throughout Europe. In 1822, his instructions to the chapters were confiscated and published, from which we excerpt, "We do not cease to recommend to you, to affiliate persons of every class and every manner of association, no matter what kind, only, provided that mystery and secrecy shall be the dominant characteristic. Under a pretext most futile, but never political or religious, created by yourselves, or better yet, caused to be created by others, associations, having in common music, the fine arts, for object. Then infiltrate the poison into those chosen arts, infiltrate it in little doses. A prince who has not a kingdom to expect, is a good fortune for us. There are many of them in that plight. These poor princes will serve our ends, while thinking to labor only for their own. They form a magnificent signboard, and there are always fools enough to be found who are ready to compromise themselves in the service of a conspiracy, of which some prince or other seems to be the ringleader. There is little morality even among the most moral of the world, and one goes fast in the way of that progress. A good hatred, thoroughly pulled, thoroughly calculated, is of more worth than all these artificial fires and all these declarations on the platform. Presently, we shall have a printing establishment at Malta placed at our disposal. We, 282, shall then be able with impunity, with a sure stroke, and under the British flag, to scatter from one end of Italy to the other, books, pamphlets, etc. which the Alta Vendita shall judge proper to put into circulation. Karl Rothschild, son of Mayor Amskill, then became head of the Alta Vendita. On May 1st, Adam Weishaupt issued further instructions to the Illuminati in Bavaria. We labor first of all to draw into our association all good and learned writers. This we imagine will be the easier obtained, as they must derive an evident advantage from it. Next to such men we seek to gain the masters and secretaries of the post offices, in order to facilitate our correspondence. The Tasso family of Bologna, later Thurnwood Taxis, gained control of post offices and intelligence work in Europe and held that power for 5 centuries. Although these groups surfaced as charitable or fine arts organizations, their goals of anarchy were concealed in all their efforts. In the 20th century, they culminated in the League of Nations, the United Nations, the Communist Party, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Foundations, and a host of lesser groups. Count Cowden hoped to clergy S. Pan-Europe movement, with its powerful backing by aristocrats and international financiers, was represented in the U.S. by its American branch, founded by Herbert Hoover and Colonel House, who were also stumping the U.S. for ratification of the League of Nations. Cowden hoped to clergy mentioned in his autobiography that he had been financed by the Rothschilds and Warburgs, and in the U.S., by Paul Warburg and Bernard Barrick. He was connected with the Thurnwood Taxis family. His grandfather, Count Francis Cowden Hoff Kalergi, Austrian ambassador in Paris, had married Marie Kalergi in 1850. She was one of the wealthiest heiresses in Europe, descended from the Byzantine Emperor Nikephor Phikis, in 1300, when Venice was the dominant power in the Mediterranean. Alexius Kalergis had signed the treaty which made Crete a dominion of Venice. A recent premier of Greece, Emmanuel Tsouteras, was a Kalergi. 283. Melchior Pelai, in The Twilight of Gold, reveals the power plays of the world order in international finance, when he quotes from the diary of Governor Emile Morel of the Bank of France. Pelai says, in October 1926, Governor Emile Morel of the Bank of France sent his closest collaborator to London to explore the tensions of Montague Norman, Governor of the Bank of England. Pierre Quesnay, then general manager of the Bank of France 1926-30, and Bank for International Settlements 1930-37, brought back a report which was recorded by Moreau. Quesnay also gives me interesting views about the ambitions of Montague Norman and the group of financiers who surround him, Sir Otto Niemeyer, Sir Arthur Salter, Sir Henry Strakosch, Sir Robert Conversely. They are striving to make London the great international financial center. But those close to Norman state this is not his objective. Point. He wants more than anything else to witness the setting up of links between the various banks of issue. Point. The economic and financial organization of the world appears to the governor of the Bank of England to be the major task of the 20th century. In his view, politicians and political institutions are in no fit state to direct with the necessary competence and continuity this task of organization which he would like to see undertaken by central banks, independent at once of governments and of private finance. Hence his campaign in favor of completely autonomous central banks, dominating their own financial markets and deriving their power from common agreement among themselves. They would succeed in taking out of the political realm those problems which are essential for the development and prosperity of the national financial security, distribution of credit, movement of prices. They would thus prevent internal political struggles from harming the wealth and the economic advancement of nations. In short, Norman wished to see the imposition of the world order over the financial affairs of the nations. It was this agreement among the central banks, rather than the front organization, the League of Nations, which became their final instrument of power. Crucial to these arrangements was the monetarist school, the Austrian school of economics, an outgrowth of the pan-Europe movement. Margit Herzfeld notes in her biography of Ludwig von Mises that he, 284, participated in Count Cowden Hofkalergi's pan-Europe movement in 1943. He had been brought to the U.S. in 1940 by a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation of $2,500 a year to work at the National Bureau of Economic Research, which grant was renewed in 1943. Von Mises' pupils, Arthur Behrens and Milton Friedman, now expound the monetary ST theory through a network of supersecret conservative think tanks led by the Mont Pelerin Society. Herzfeld says that von Mises' most famous protege was the Soviet apologist Murray Rothbard. One of the most influential conspirators was Walter Rathenau of Germany. He greeted the First World War ecstatically, as the golden opportunity to establish world socialism. He wrote on July 31st, "For years I had foreseen the twilight of the nations that I had heralded in my speeches and writings. A people's state, by Rathenau. The notion became established that the state is no longer to be regarded as the importunate poor relation and thought off grudgingly with a tithe, but that it is entitled to dispose of the capital and income of all its members at its own free will." Rathenau's dictum was enacted into law by the far-reaching and multi-billion entitlement programs of Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society, when he persuaded Congress to levy against all of the capital and income of the American people, placing it at his disposal to achieve world order political goals, and finally forcing the nation to the verge of bankruptcy. Rathenau wrote in Days to Come, 1921, "No part of the world is now closed to us. No material tasks are beyond our powers. All the treasures of earth are within our grasp. No thought remains hidden. Every undertaking can be put to the task and realized. The fertilizing distribution of the possessions of the world is our task. We must discover the force that will affect an up and down movement of the masses. In the New Society, 1921, Raffineau wrote, "A far-reaching policy of socialization is necessary and urgent. The goal of the world revolution upon which we have entered means in its material aspect the melting of all society into one." 2s5. This was the leveling effect which was a key goal of the conspirators, the Illuminati and the Alta Vendita, resulting in anarchy and the breaking down of national and class borders. Before he could realize his dream of world socialism, Raffineau was murdered. Ortega noted the phenomenon of leveling in the revolt of the masses, a hurricane of thersicality, everywhere and in every form, is presently raging over the lands of Europe. Almost all the positions taken up and proclaimed are false ones. We are living in comic fashion, all the more comic the more apparently tragic is the mask adopted put on. The comic exists, wherever life has no basis of inevitableness on which a stand is taken without reserves. Never, as now have we these lives without substance or art, derisines from their own destiny, who let themselves float on the lightest current. Ortega was commenting on the most striking phenomenon of the 20th century, the hegemony of parasitism which was attained through the world order. It was the Congress of 1815 at Vienna which unleashed the rats from their nests, nor is it accidental that the Viennese school of economics has become the principal vehicle through which the world order maintains its political and financial power. After crushing Napoleon, the emerging oligarchy, which owed no allegiance to any nation or to any philosophy of life, attained power, because it knew how to defeat its foes, the republicans and individualists of Europe, but its foes had no idea how to combat, or even to identify, its cleverly camouflaged enemy, because these people were a biological throwback in the continuing development of humanity. They were persons who were unable to become productive members of any society, and who could exist only by maintaining a parasitic attachment upon a host. Incredibly, they seized upon this striking difference as a sign that they had been chosen to rule all of mankind. Initially no more than a harmless illusion, this self-deception was transformed into an evidence of superiority. Their biological uniqueness, their committal to a parasitic mode of life, became their principal advantage in attaining their goals. They set up techniques of immediately recognizing each other in any part of the world. They resolved to act always cohesively, as well-trained and determined. 286. Phalanx against their unwitting opposition. They made full use of their qualities of non-allegiance and non-alignment, which was actually enmity, undying hatred towards all nations, races and creeds of the host peoples who tolerated their presence. This freedom from all loyalties and moral codes of the kinds which governed all other groups gave them an enormous tactical advantage over those whom they planned to enslave and destroy. The conspirators knew that their parasitic way of life would not be long endured by any host. They had to set up a program to subdue and overcome all governments, all religious creeds, all group loyalties, and replace them with their own world order, which would allow any type of perversion, as long as the host peoples tolerated the presence of the parasite. The old morality had been based upon the duties and responsibilities of the citizen to raise a family, attend church, and support his nation. The new morality, the liberation theology, swept away all duties of the citizen. He now only had a single duty, to obey the world order. In return, he was relieved of duties, and was free to gratify his needs, his sexual desires, perverted gratifications with children and animals, abandonment of monogamous life. The new morality reduced the citizen to a mere animal, which was what the world order required in order to perpetuate its parasitic way of life. Society was now replaced by a mere facade of society. Only one crime would be severely punished, any resistance to the world order. Murder, rape, arson, armed robbery, incest, child molestation, alcoholism, drug addiction, homosexuality, all would be excused as minor aberrations, as long as the world order was allowed to function without hindrance. One former crime, treason, now vanished, because national loyalties no longer existed. No one was expected to be loyal to the world order, except its own members. The hospitables, the slaves, would never be asked for loyalty, only for obedience. Despite this new tolerance, which was in itself a revolution against the innate moral codes of all peoples, many citizens continued to resist enslavement by the world order. Famines, riots, revolutions and wars were instigated to get rid of the troublemakers, but a more universal restraint was required. This was found in drugs. In Asia, for 287 centuries, assassins had been sent to carry out their duties after being given quantities of drugs. Assassin comes from the word for hashish. The world order realized that drugs would provide the means of behavioral psychology or people control, which they had been seeking. The opium clippers began to sail from England to the Far East. By pushing drugs among the Asian masses, they stupefied and controlled them, reaping not only a substantial cash flow, but the raw materials needed for their industrial revolution. In the 20th century, the foundations began to stupefy the European and American population with drugs, the final step in the enthronement of the world order. They had eradicated the last serious resistance to their program. All conspiratorial societies, for the past 1,000 years, have sought a single goal, hegemony of parasitism. Bharatidharma holds that the world is an order or cosmos, that it is not chaos, it is not thrown together. Parasitism's existential philosophy holds that man is thrown into the world without plan or program. This is the basic concept of parasitism, which finds itself in the world with only one mission, to find a host or perish. Many physicists now claim that the universe is the result of an accidental explosion which threw its components hither and yon, with no plan or order, an atheistic concept which denies that there is either a logician or logic to the universe. Dharma states that it is the desire for the life of form which produces the universe, that there is a world order by which the universe is upheld. The parasite denies that there is a world order of the universe, or any desire for form in the universe, or that any form exists. Therefore, the parasite is free to impose his own world order, which has no organic relationship to the universe or to form. The hegemony of parasitism is dedicated solely to maintaining its position on the host from which it draws all of its sustenance. The host is the entire universe of the parasite. He knows nothing beyond it, and desires to know nothing beyond it. Geoffrey LePage writes in Parasitic Animals, "Some species of parasitic animals are among the most powerful enemies of man and his civilization." He posits a law of nature, that the parasite is always smaller and weaker than its host. 288. And that the parasite always disguises itself and its aim in order to carry out its parasitic mission. LePage says, "The struggle between host and parasite went on according to the laws of evolution, and this battle is constantly being waged today." LePage notes that the parasite can cause biological change, citing particular species which cause changes in the host's reproductive glands. The parasite sometimes castrates the host in order to weaken it, such as the parasitic crustacean Siculina, which destroys the reproductive organs of its host, the short-tailed spider crab, Inachusma botanicus. We see the identical process today in which the hegemony of parasitism seeks to alter the reproductive process of the host by converting the intergeneration to unisex and homosexuality, and to render ineffective distinctive sexual characteristics of male and female. This is a classic instance of castration by the parasite. The natural world order, which is based upon the irrevocable laws of the universe, has been temporarily replaced on Earth by the unnatural world order of the parasite. All of the programs and energies of the parasite are devoted to a single goal, maintaining his feeding position upon the host. Freudian psychology was developed by the parasitic order to neutralize the incessant efforts of the host to throw off or dislodge the parasite. Any move to dislodge the parasite is denounced as reactionary. It is defined and outlawed as an act of aggression, hostility, and alienation. In fact, the host is merely trying to survive by throwing off the parasite. Another law of nature is that the parasite, not only by sucking off the life sustenance of the host, but also by altering its life cycle, will inevitably kill the host. This process is called the decline and fall of civilization. LePage notes that a parasite is not a particular species, but one which has adopted a certain way of life, the way of the parasite. Whether or not it is a virus, the parasite has a viral effect on the host, slowly poisoning and destroying it. Viruses are classic parasites. The spirochete, virus of syphilis, is a classic parasitic organism. In biological parlance, a collection of spirochetes is known as a congress. 289. The U.S. Congress has specifically chartered many parasitic functions in the philanthropic foundations. These groups now dominate educational and governmental institutions, laying down financial and social goals which are designed solely to maintain the hegemony of parasitism through its world order. The American foundations are not even run by Americans, their policies are formulated in London by the financiers and transmitted to this country through the British Army Bureau of Psychological Warfare front of the Stock Institute. This is a typical disguised parasitic operation. Censorship and observance of its biological taboos are the basis of the tribal rule of parasitism. The most stringent taboo, one which has never been violated, is the taboo against any mention of parasitism as a force or power in society. No newspaper, magazine, radio or television program, or school or university course has ever been allowed to mention the societal impact of parasitism. It is the greatest and most universal taboo in the world today. Michael Volonsky's nomenklatura, the Soviet elite identifies the communist new class as a parasitic group. In reviewing this work in Fortune October 1, 5, 1984, Daniel Seligman notes, Volonsky's portrait leaves us thinking that the nomenklatura is an entirely parasitic operation. Its interests are clearly not those of most Soviet citizens. The same observation can be made of the world order's ruling group in any nation today, and particularly in the United States. Despite its present hegemony, the world order of parasitism realizes that it is always subject to being dislodged, which, in effect, would mean its destruction. Therefore, it is necessary to control not only the channels of communication of the host, but his very thought processes as well, to maintain constant vigilance that the host does not develop any concept of the danger of his situation, or any power to throw off the parasite. Therefore, the parasite carefully instructs the host that he exists only because of the benign presence of the parasite, that he owes everything to the presence of the parasite, his religion, his social order, his monetary system, and his educational system. The parasite deliberately inculcates in the host the fear that, if 290. The parasite happens to be dislodged, the host will lose all these things, and be left with nothing. Although the world order has control of the legal system and the courts, it remains vulnerable to any enforcement of the pre-existing body of law which the host had formulated to protect his society. This body of law forbids everything that the parasite is doing, and forces the parasite to maintain a precarious existence outside of the law. If the law were to be enforced at any time, the parasite would be dislodged. The existing body of law clearly forbids the operation of criminal syndicates, which is precisely what the hegemony of parasitism and its world order is. Criminal syndicalism denies the equal protection of the law to citizens. Only by acting against criminal syndicalism can the state protect its citizens. Corpus Juris Secundum 16, Constitutional Law 213, 10. States, the constitutional guarantee of freedom of speech does not include the right to advocate, or conspire to effect, the violent destruction or overthrow of the government or the criminal destruction of property. 214. The constitutional guarantee of the right of assembly was never intended, as a license for illegality or invitation for fraud. The right of freedom of assembly may be abused by using assembly to incite violence and crime, and the people through their legislatures may protect themselves against the abuse. The assembly of any world order organization, such as the Council on Foreign Relations or any foundation, is subject to the laws against fraud. Their charters claim they are engaged in philanthropy, and enforcement of the laws against criminal syndicalism would end the institutions through which the world order illegally rules the people of the United States, the illegal conspiracies and the introduction of alien laws into our system by the foundation's instructions to Congress. We have already shown that the Rockefeller Foundation and other key organizations of the world order are syndicates, which are engaged in the practice of criminal syndicalism. But what is a syndicate? The Oxford English Dictionary notes that the word stems from syndic. A syndic is defined as an officer of government. 291. A chief magistrate, a deputy. In 1601, R. Johnson wrote in King and Common with Specialmen, called syndics, who hog the managing of the whole commonwealth. Thus the Rockefeller Foundation and its associated groups are carrying out their delegated function of managing the entire commonwealth, but not for the benefit of the people, or of any government except the secret supergovernment, the world order, which they serve. The OED further defines a syndic as a censor of the actions of another. To accuse. Here too, the syndicate functions according to its definition. The syndicate censors all thought and media, primarily to protect its own power. It also brings accusations, as many American citizens have found to their sorrow. Not even Sir Walter Raleigh was immune. When he interfered with the international money trade, he was accused of treason and beheaded. The OED defines a syndicate as follows. 3. A combination of capitalists and financiers entered into, for the purpose of prosecuting a scheme requiring large sources of capital, especially one having the object of obtaining control of the market in a particular commodity. To control, manage or effect by a syndicate. Note the key words in this definition, a combination, prosecuting, obtaining control. The scheme does not require large capital, it requires large sources of capital, the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve System. Corpus Juris Secundum 22 says of criminal syndicalism, in a prosecution for being a member of an organization which teaches and abets criminal syndicalism, evidences of crimes committed by past or present members of the organization in their capacity, as members is admissible to show its character. People v. LaRue 216 p. 627 ca. 276, thus testimony about John Foster Dulles financing the Nazi government of Germany, his telegram starting the Korean War, and other evidence can be used to indict any member of the Rockefeller Foundation in any state or locality in which the Rockefeller Foundation has ever been active in any way. Since these organizations are all closely interlocked, and there is so much available evidence of their illegal operations, it will be relatively simple to obtain criminal convictions against them for their criminal syndicalist operations. 292. Corpus Juris Secundum 22, Criminal Law 185.10. Conspiracy and monopolies, where the statute makes mere membership in an organization formed to promote syndicalism a crime, without an overt act, this offense is indictable in any county into which a member may go during the continuance of his membership, and this is true, although such member comes into a county involuntarily. People v. Johansson, 226 p. 634,66 c. a. 343. Corpus Juris Secundum 22, Criminal Law Seconds 182, 3, states, a prosecution for conspiracy to commit an offense against the U.S. may also be tried in any district wherein any overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy is performed. U.S. v. Cohen C. A. N. J. 197 F. Second 26. Thus a publication by the Council on Foreign Relations promoting the stripping of sovereignty of the United States of America, mailed into any county of the U.S., the county authorities can bring the Council on Foreign Relations, or any member therein, to trial in that county, and any action by any member of the Council on Foreign Relations in the past is admissible, as evidence, such as Starling World War II, subsidizing the Nazi government, or subsidizing the USSR. Criminal syndicalism can also be prosecuted according to Corpus Juris Secundum 46, Insurrection and Sedition, Seconds 461 c. Sabotage and syndicalism aiming to abolish the present political and social system, including direct action or sabotage. Thus any program of a foundation which seeks to abolish the present political or social system of the United States can be prosecuted. Of course every foundation program seeks to accomplish just that, and is indictable. Not only individuals, but any corporation supporting criminal syndicalism can be prosecuted, according to Corpus Juris Secundum 46-462b. Criminal syndicalism. Statutes against criminal syndicalism apply to corporations as well as to individuals organizing or belonging to criminal syndicalist society. Evidence of the character and activities of other organizations with which the organization in which the accused is a member is affiliated is admissible. 293. Not only can the members of the world order be arrested and tried anywhere, since they function worldwide in their conspiratorial activities to undermine and overthrow all governments and nations, but because if your organizations are so tightly interlocked, any evidence about any one of them can be introduced in prosecuting any member of other organizations in any part of the US or the world. Their attempts to undermine the political and social orders of all peoples make them subject to legal retribution. The people of the U.S. must begin at once to enforce the statutes outlawing criminal syndicalist activities, and bring the criminals to justice. Being well aware of their danger, the world order is working frantically to achieve even greater dictatorial powers over the nations of the world. They constantly intensify all problems through the foundations, so that political and economic crises prevent the peoples of the world from organizing against them. The world order must paralyze its opponents. They terrorize the world with propaganda about approaching international nuclear war, although atomic bombs have been used only once, in 1945, when the Rockefeller Foundation director Carl T. Compton ordered Truman to drop the atomic bomb on Japan. Because of the billions of lives which have been blighted and destroyed by the conspiracies of the world order throughout its hegemony of parasitism, vengeance for these atrocities demands the most thoroughgoing and relentless retribution against the criminal syndicalists. Their record is clear. In 1984, as these words are written, we are observing the year of 1984. George Orwell's book, written in 1949, was thought to be only a warning against what was to come. It was not a warning. 1984 is the program. Orwell, a lifelong socialist, fought for many days in the front lines for the communists in Spain. He was wounded, but this did not lessen his dedication to the goals of world socialism. The most practical way to achieve these goals was to formulate the program, as Colonel House had done in Philip Drew, Administrator. Orwell laid down the dictum that slogans must be in Newspeak, "War is peace." 294. Freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. This is the program of the hegemony of parasitism through the world order. Orwell posited three superstates, Eurasia, Oceania, and East Asia, permanently at war in one combination or another. He continues, "War, however, is no longer the desperate annihilating struggle that it was in the early decades of the 20th century. It is a warfare of limited aims, between combatants who are unable to destroy one another, have no material cause for fighting, and are not divided by a genuine ideological difference. There is no longer in a material sense anything to fight about, the balance of power will always remain roughly even, and the territory which forms the heartland of each superstate always remains inviolate." Note, the present writer has pointed out that the CIA does not commit sabotage in Russia, and the KGB does not commit sabotage in the US. Point. The primary aim of modern warfare, in accordance with the principle of doublethink, the aim is simultaneously recognized and not recognized by the directing brains of the party, is to use up the products of the machine without raising the general standard of living. The essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. The two aims of the party are to conquer the whole surface of the earth and to extinguish once and for all the possibility of independent thought. Orwell concludes 1984 with a denial that the victims of the world order have any hope. He claims the world order will always triumph, which is a great propaganda achievement for the hegemony of parasitism. He writes, "If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face, forever." He disposes of his hero, a citizen who had vainly tried to oppose the party, by ending the book with the hero whimpering that he loved Big Brother. The peoples of the world not only will never love Big Brother, but they will soon dispose of him forever. The program of the world order remains the same, divide and conquer. "And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight everyone against his brother, and everyone against his neighbor, city shall fight against city, and kingdom against kingdom." Isaiah 19:2. At the same time that government officials are stealthily. 295. You. Promoting discord in every region of the land, they are also setting up government programs which will step in to set up total dictatorship over the warring factions. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, now controls the FBI, state and local police departments, and have extensive plans for national concentration camps throughout the United States. George Bush and Colonel North in 1984 ran Rex 84 Readiness Exercise in 1984 as a shakedown run for a national dictatorship. Houston researcher William Pabst released a pamphlet in 1983, Concentration Camp Plans for U.S. Citizens, formulated under an operations plan named Garden Plot and Cable Splicer, calling for martial law. Bush now has a secret hideout, Mount Weather, near Barrowville, Virginia, which is 300 feet underground, as headquarters for the New World Order. It already has 240 workers. The Federal Reserve System bunker at Culpeper, Virginia, was built 22 years ago as a communications and record center. It formerly contained enormous quantities of cash, which have quietly been removed. These are the physical manifestations of preparations for a worldwide dictatorship, which the Trilateral Commission report, drafted at a commission meeting in Washington, April 22, 1990, calls beyond interdependence, the meshing of the world's economy and the Earth's ecology. David Rockefeller, in his preface to this report, states, "The authors demonstrate that the world has now moved beyond economic interdependence to ecological interdependence and intermeshing of the two." Jim McNeil, author of the report, is now advising me on the road to Rio. Rio will be the largest summit conference ever held, and it will have the political capacity to produce the basic changes needed in our national and international economic agendas and in our institutions of governance to ensure a secure and sustainable future for the world community. By the year 2012, these changes must be fully integrated into our economic and political life. What Rockefeller demands is that we change our institutions of government by 2012 to encompass all the goals of the world order. The Trilateral Commission, Questions and Answers, 1-990. Obtainable from the North American Office, 345 E46 St. New York, New York 10017, telephone 212-661-1180, asks, what are the goals of the Trilateral Commission? 296. 1. Growing interdependence is a fact of life in the contemporary world. It transcends and influences national systems. It requires new and more intensive forms of international cooperation to realize its benefits and to counteract economic and political nationalism. Also proposed is a new constitution for the United States. Art. 8th Secretary 1-2. No person shall bear arms or possess lethal weapons, except police, members of the armed forces, or those licensed under law. This has been the law in all communist countries for many years. The would-be dictators hope to confiscate the 200 million weapons now in private hands in the United States. Section 8 of the new Constitution provides, the use of public lands, the air, or waters shall be a privilege granted only in the national interest and with restrictions imposed by authorized agencies. Art 2nd, the Electoral Board, provides for an overseer to supervise all political parties and candidates. This is the same overseer which had absolute power on the pre-Civil War plantations. History does repeat itself. Unfortunately for the megalomaniac plans of the minions of the world order, they are fighting a losing battle. Time is running out for them. Their world order, which they tried to revive by hastily terming it a new world order, is slowly collapsing, speeded in its demise by the rapid increase in communications, the computer, television, and other factors of modern life. The world order, which has always been based upon naked force, worked best in the pre-industrial age. Because it depends on planning and total control of the economy, world order programs are too inflexible to survive in the fast-moving world of today. Within the next several years, if not, indeed, in the next few months, we shall see an exasperated and aroused public complete what has already taken place in communist satellites and in Soviet Russia, the final dismantling of the communist system of the world order in the United States itself. This is not romanticism or optimism, it is the result of many years of studying present developments, and of a realistic assessment of the prospect before us. It will be a very rewarding one, except for the parasites whose curse on humanity will at last be removed. This is the 21st century, as I see it. 297.